Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
I'm Eric Wing, and I am the author of Things We Lost to the Water, a novel. I'm also the editor-in-chief of Diacritics.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Wonderful. Thank you for coming on. My guest today is Eric Nguyen, author of Things We Lost to the Water. I immediately went out and got the copy of your book after it landed on Obama's reading list in 2021. And I learned in the process that you're the editor-in-chief at Diacritics. It's a Vietnamese diasporic publication that showcases Vietnamese artists from around the world. I start all of my episodes with the question of, what does it mean to be Vietnamese to you?
I think being Vietnamese, that's a very complex question, because there are so many strains or different ways of being Vietnamese. But I think if I were to lump Vietnameseness into an entity, I would say we come from a shared culture, traditions, but also a history as well. But also we are kind of looking forward into what it means to be a Vietnamese person. And I think that spans all different shores. If you are a Vietnamese American, that's a different type of Vietnameseness from a Vietnamese person in Vietnam versus a Vietnamese person in Canada or Australia. So I think it's a huge net, I would say, of shared origin, shared history, but then we go in different directions and write our own stories, our own new histories.
Yeah, I talk quite a bit about that phenomenon on the podcast, because you know that question, the answer, it varies so often, and where we grow up has massive consequences to who we become. Yeah, and you know, somebody growing up in the East Coast and somebody growing up in the West Coast of the United States are very, very different people. You could come from the same family almost and, you know, become very different people.
Yeah, definitely. I think a reduced kind of start in the same place, but that's like even a generalization. But yeah, I think like especially like the cultures, the Vietnamese American cultures, like differ so much. Like I know like on the West Coast, like there's like a really prominent community that there's like this, that's the biggest population of Vietnamese Americans in the U.S. compared to people on the East Coast who might not have as big of a community of other Vietnamese people. So you see people kind of moving away from that. And then we have people like in the South, like where my novel takes place, and they have like their own culture that's rooted in Southernness that is like not understandable to people like on the East Coast or West Coast at all. So I think, yeah, definitely, like we do build our own culture wherever we are.
Yeah, and I was very surprised to learn, you know, after I read your novel that you grew up in Maryland and not in New Orleans. You know, that's a big risk. That's a big leap to kind of transplant your your mind to write about a whole pocket of a community that you did not grow up in. How did you come to be so comfortable writing from that place?
I think at first I was really uncomfortable because it's not my community. I didn't grow up there. I am an outsider. So it was trying to tell a story, but also being respectful to the people there. At the same time, also learning about how they live, how they see their lives. So I think it was my research, talking to people there, seeing how they see their community, how they live their everyday lives. I think getting to understand them as, I guess, New Orleanian Vietnamese Americans, but also just as individual people. I think that gave me insight into how I can write this book. And like, honestly, like once the book came out, I was like still nervous about like how specifically that population, that community would react to the book. So far it's been good, which I felt like it's an honor. Like I've been mistaken for someone who had lived there. I remember talking to someone from the Vietnamese community there, and he was like, do I know your family? Are you from here? And I was like, no, but I'm glad that kind of came through in a way, because I really try to be authentic as much as I can, coming from an outsider perspective.
You know, the way I perceived you after finishing the book was somebody who grew up there but was an outsider. That it made you feel like somebody who is, you know, from that community, but you always felt like an outsider within that community. That was the feeling that I got after reading it.
Yeah, I think the way that I put the outsiderness is that I made the family kind of even not part of the community. I mean, like the community down there and in the book is really Catholic, for example, and have a character who is not really religious. She kind of distance herself from that. So I think that kind of made it easier to write like as an outsider, because I am an outsider, and in a way the characters are also outsiders within their own home. So I think that really helped me. But I think like even growing up as a queer Vietnamese American person, like there was also that outsiderness that I experienced. So I think it kind of felt natural to be writing about an outsider within this, also an outsider community from like mainstream white America.
You know, the gang side, the brother in the gang, how much research did you have to do for that?
I feel like not a lot of research. I mean, I read, I Love Yous for White People by Black Sue. And he does discuss part of that in his book, but like I did grow up in an area that did have Vietnamese American gangs. Like my sister was for a while, like had a boyfriend in one. So like it's something that I grew up with that was kind of around me. So I felt like it was just natural to tell coming of age story with that in there. And also I felt like it's really a part of the Vietnamese American community that really you don't see a lot in media, kind of because it goes against like this image of like the model minority, which sometimes like Vietnamese people are kind of put into that box. But I also think like in order to get a fuller picture of our community, like we have to talk about like, I guess, the bad things that happened there. I mean, we're not these model minority, like things aren't always okay with us. And I think giving insight to that really gives a humanity to our communities, because we're no longer just like this monolith of like straight A people in school who become doctors and lawyers. We're multifaceted. We can be good, we can be bad. And I think that makes us it validates that we're human. And I think that's such an important thing, especially for minority writers, minority communities who are always, they feel like you have to be like the perfect, for example, perfect Vietnamese person in front of everyone, or else like there people are going to judge your community. But I think it's we see a lot of people moving on from that, especially like from my generation.
What was your childhood like? Did you have to conform much?
I think I did in a way conform to, but I think it was a way just to like fit in. I mean, no one wants to be an outsider in wherever they are. I mean, you're at school, you do want to make friends, so that there is that want to conform, to be like the kid who doesn't bring the Vietnamese food to school, but like wants to like buy lunch and get that hamburger or pizza. And I think part of me was like, especially my teenage years, like I really pushed away that Vietnamese-ness. Like I knew like as like elementary school student, like I took Vietnamese classes, for example, but then I stopped going to those Vietnamese classes and I kind of did lose that language. But like at the time it was like okay with me. Like I made me feel more American among all these other teenagers who basically they only knew English. But so yeah, there was this pressure to conform. And like it kind of created like this divide really between like my home life, where like I was supposed to be like this dutiful son who carried on traditions, who was Vietnamese, compared to having to live out, go outside, go to school, hang out with friends, where I felt I need to be American to kind of get ahead, kind of fit in, try to be like a normal person, like a normal.
Yeah. Yeah. And when did you get this sort of inkling that you wanted to be a writer?
I think I, in a way I've always been like a storyteller. I mean, I remember like in first grade, I wrote like this really small story. It was like just a way for us to like practice handwriting. It was a contest. And then like I wrote a story. It was like about a leprechaun who lived like in a wardrobe, and I won a prize for that. So I guess that's when the idea of being a writer came into mind. But like I always like to tell stories. Like I growing up, like Saturdays on the weekends, like we didn't really have a lot of entertainment in my house. So like me and my brother, we just share stories. Eventually, like we wrote them down just for fun. But I never really saw it as like a way to like a job. Like in a Vietnamese family, like your options are really like a doctor or lawyer or dentist or whatnot. And like I didn't even know that you could like actually go to school to become a writer. So like after undergrad, I was in a phase like I didn't really know what to do. I knew that I had this like side hobby of writing that I like to do. But then I learned more about there are schools out there you can get degrees in, you can really practice this craft. So I think the short answer is I kind of always knew I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know how to do it until a little later in life. And then I guess I did whatever I could to get there.
And did you go to school for something other than writing, you know, in undergrad? Were you in a different trajectory?
Yeah, my undergrad was, I studied sociology. I mean, like for my parents, I was convincing them like it's a great degree for like becoming a lawyer, even though like in the back of my mind, I was like, no, I'm not being a lawyer. So like after I graduated, like it was like, where's the law school? And I was like, maybe I'll become like a social worker. That's, I mean, no money in social work, but that's respectable, that you could help people. So I felt like that's the lies I told my parents until I had to go to grad school. And I felt like I'm moving away for 3 years and surprise, I'm going to try to be a writer. So that's my trajectory with my own family.
You know, you make it sound so simple. Like, you know, you go to school, you get sociology degree, and then you just move away for 3 years to study writing. But I feel like with artists and, you know, this journey of becoming who you are and having that confidence to pursue the path, it's a gradual thing. But what along your life's journey kind of galvanized this direction for you?
I think after I took like this creative writing workshop, it was a workshop with like a nonprofit that kind of cultivates LGBTQ writers. And I applied to it on a whim. Like I saw the opportunity. I saw like, it was like a week you can just hang out with other like real writers to me, and just like take some classes. And I got in, to my surprise, and it was there like I guess the teacher I studied under was like, she said like, you had real talent, you have to develop it. Like, I'm not gonna let you like go out of this and not continue this path. So I think that was like something that snapped me, or a light bulb went off and say, hey, I might be onto something, that I might have this thing called talent. But I guess even after that, there was like a lot of doubts about like, how do you do this? I mean, you could go to school, but like, who graduates from school and become like what they actually want? Like, I didn't become a sociologist. I didn't become a lawyer or a social worker, which was like the plan I had. So like going into grad school, that in itself was a risk, kind of almost like a leap of faith of maybe I can do this. And like, even throughout the MFA program, there was also that nagging voice, like, maybe I'm not good at this. Maybe I'll just get this degree and then end up working at a place I don't like, doing stuff I don't like. So I think it's a process you have to go through, figuring out that you want to do it in the first place, and then figuring out how to deal with all that self-doubt, those voices in your head that tells you like, this is not for you, like really imposter syndrome, is what it comes down to. And it's just, I mean, even to this day, even with a book out, there's like the sense like, no, I can't write another book, even though like I did it before. It's like, and like, even like when Obama said like he liked my book, I was like, no, that can't be right. I kept on looking at social media, like, maybe that's not my name, maybe that's not my book. And
wow.
Like it's always there. I feel you just have to kind of not listen to it, even though that itself can be hard.
And it's still there now.
Yeah, definitely. Like, even like, I'm working on another novel, and like, I feel like I don't know what I'm doing. I feel like this, it's even more pressure, because I feel like with the first novel, like, no one knows you and you could fail and that's okay. But now, like, I have a book out, people kind of think I'm this like this really smart person, this person with things to say. And then like, I sit down every morning to write, and like, do I have anything to say? Do I have anything smart to say? Can I actually write another novel? And I think it's something that the writers, artists will just have to deal with for a lifetime, but like, hopefully it gets easier.
How do you answer the question when that comes up? Are you good enough? Are you like, what am I doing? You know, I'm not a writer. Like, when that starts to kind of like cycle through, how do you get out of it, and how do you kind of like punch through it?
I think just doing the work of writing. I felt like, just, I'm the kind of person, for good or for bad, that I just like push through, like whatever problems I have. I feel like growing up like that, that's how I was brought up, as like the son of refugees. I feel like that's part of like the refugee ethos, is that you push through because that's how you survive. Like, I saw my parents like working two jobs, like that's what they had to do. They couldn't complain. They complained. They didn't have that luxury to complain. And I guess growing up and seeing that, I kind of had that become one of my traits. So like, I really like, if that happens, like, I just push through that I do have a routine of writing. I wake up like at 5 every morning and write for like 3 or 4 hours before I go to my day job. And I think just having that space that I tell myself, like, no matter what, whatever I'm thinking, I will sit down for these hours and write. I'm not going to judge myself or why I write, if it's good or bad. I just push myself through it. I think by the time like I push myself through enough writing, that voice in my head that says like, you're not a writer, it's there, but kind of silenced, because like, I could like point to the screen, like, if I'm not a writer, I wrote these pages, it's like, what do you mean? So I think seeing that I can do it really helped me kind of deal with that voice in my head.
What do your parents think today?
I mean, they know my book is there. But like, I feel like, I mean, like my sister, my older sister, she's a scientist. She's successful. She did exactly what she told him she would do. But then there's me. I feel like I'm the oddball child. I'm the only one who went into humanities and the arts. And like, I guess like they're happy for me. They congratulate me on like the success. But then I feel like you kind of know that they're like, but he isn't a doctor. He isn't a lawyer. And like okay, but I guess I'll take that. I'm okay with being like the black sheep of my family, even if I guess what I needed was that pat on the back to say like I'm doing okay. At this point, that's enough for me.
Yeah, yeah. But damn, the goddamn president said that this book was on his reading list. I mean, you know, that's just like mind-blowing to think about that, you know, and I'm sure that you and I are both, we share that. We're fans of President Obama, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely.
How did, you have so many questions prepared, but, you know, I want to kind of like talk about the things that, you know, come up in the conversation. This idea of a day job, what is it that you do as a day job?
Well, I have multiple day jobs in a way, just me. So I work at a nonprofit for my day job doing communications work, writing related, but not like as creative. I feel like I do need that buffer because creative writing like takes a certain, I guess, part of your brain to do compared to like writing communications, which is like, I wouldn't say dry, but like it's not, you're not like as tied to it emotionally. You just have to have something, you write something that gets the job done. So I guess that's one of my day jobs. My other day jobs is to edit a publication, Diaspora Critics, which highlights the work of Vietnamese diasporic artists. When I say diasporic, I feel like that's very important because it's not just Vietnamese Americans. We publish Vietnamese Australians, Vietnamese Canadians, Vietnamese German people. So I think like it brings me a lot of joy to do that because it's kind of cultivating this global network of Vietnamese people around the world and showing how we're all kind of the same in a way, but also like how we're so different from each other. And I think that really fights against like that stereotype of like what it means to be Vietnamese, because there are a lot of ways to be Vietnamese.
Yeah. And that's why I always ask it, because I think there's so much variety to being Vietnamese. There's just so many ways to make Nguyen Mam or so many ways to make pho. And, you know, there's some basic building blocks, but for the most part, there's a lot of ways to do these things. And I want to ask you, with the work that you do with the diaspora and the sort of the editing, the kind of the amplifying of these voices of artists. And I'm asking because I share this sort of journey of amplifying, and I wonder all the time, do you feel like this diaspora has legs in terms of us being second generation refugee, product of refugee, we have this sort of like this thorn in our side that we just can't get out, right? We just always have to talk about it. We always have to like direct our attention to it. But three or four generations from now, you know, is that still going to be there? Or are we just sort of like the people that are creating this legacy for our consumption? But, you know, generations from now, it kind of loses its stickiness.
I think that's kind of difficult to answer because like it could really go either way. But I think like right now it's clear that there's like this movement of Vietnamese artists that are telling these stories, especially of like the history of their parents, of Vietnamese people in general. I think especially in people outside of Vietnam, because like I remember like there's some writer wrote that like the first generation of immigrants, they're trying to survive, they're trying to live their lives, and it's not until like the second generation who are out there like they want to tell the stories. The first generation was not able to tell the stories. They were too busy in a way. And the second generation is there to kind of tell a story of their elders to pass that down. Because like for me, especially, I feel like if I didn't tell a story, like some part of me would be almost like lost almost, because like my parents' story about their story, I wouldn't be there. So like telling that story was important for I mean, sounds dramatic, but like to my survival, to my identity, I think that's a better way to say it. But I think, especially like in different countries, once we assimilate into like more of this bigger mainstream culture, there is that risk of kind of like erasing that Vietnamese-ness. I mean, like on the one hand, like one doesn't want to be like the token Vietnamese person in an art gallery and in a book lineup, for example. But like one just wants to see themselves as an artist, but then at the cost of kind of losing that history of Vietnamese-ness. So there is that risk. But at the same time, I think as long as we pass those stories forward, the next generation, they can take that and kind of reinvent it. They can realize a different future for this Vietnamese-ness. So I think the optimistic side of me, I can see that happening. I mean, like, if I can do it, take the stories from my parents, the next generation can take my story plus the stories of my parents and take that and run and do really creative things about it. They can also mix it up with mainstream culture and we could get something really beautiful, really something interesting. So that's the optimistic in me. And like, that's the future like I envision really.
When you approach a story like a novel, the first novel that you do, I am sure that the lineup of stories that you have is infinity, because creative people always have so many stories. How do you know that this is where this story, this novel, this setting, this particular niche of your life is something that you want to spend the next 3 to 5 years, you know, chiseling away at?
I think for this first novel, it was kind of easy. I felt like it was, I mean, I had different ideas already for different novels, but I think I wanted to tackle things across the water first because I felt like it was so personal for me. In a way, it was my way of trying to understand my own Vietnamese heritage, where my parents came from, their experience. I mean, like growing up, they didn't talk a lot about their experiences as refugees. Like, I felt like they were the kind of people who didn't want to share that trauma with their kids. Like growing up, like they always told us to look forward, see, get good grades, see what you can become tomorrow in the future. So I think part of me felt like I was, part of my identity was missing. So I felt like writing this book, doing the research, it was like, no argument. I had to write this book. This needed to be the first book I wrote, or else like I felt like I would have gone like a couple more years feeling kind of lost in my own Vietnamese identity. So I think for me, like this was an obvious choice. And I think like if I don't want to think this, but like if I don't write another book, I would be happier with this book because it meant so much to me personally. And anything else I write after this, it will be fun to write, but it won't be as personal. I guess that's how I decided to write this novel and how I would measure like the other novels that come after this.
And when you say easy, how long did it take you to write?
7 years. So not easy.
You know, I just talked to T-Bui the other week. 10 years for hers. Wow. It's intense. What keeps you going? What keeps you inspired?
I think like I said, like it was a really personal project, but I think part of it was also like part of it was written when I was in my graduate program, and like to pass the graduate program to graduate, you needed to have like a pretty solid draft of it. So that really helped. But yeah. I think after I graduated, it was just a strive to finish this personal project. But also, like I said, I'm the kind of person who likes to see things through, likes to just move forward. And I think like a part of me just like would be bothered that this novel wasn't finished. Like putting aside the personal aspect of it, like I would just be like, why did I finish that? Like, I just need to finish it because like, otherwise like this thing will be looming over me that I didn't finish it.
You know, it's as somebody who's the editor in chief of something like Diacritics, how do you know when things are good? How do you know when an artist is making good work?
I think when there's like particular joy when I find someone's work. I mean, it doesn't need to be like this joy of, wow, I'm so happy that I see this. It's more of a joy of seeing a piece of writer, a short story, an essay that has a unique point of view, something that I might not have considered before, but also someone who has a unique story, has a unique way of telling that story. I mean, like, there are a lot of people, there are a lot of Vietnamese people, each one of them has a story, but it's more of a way you tell that story and how do you make that transcend just your own personal story? How can you make that into this statement? I'm not to say like a statement that encompasses like what it means to be Vietnamese, but what it means to be this particular person, this particular moment that you're writing from. So I guess there needs to be a spark of originality of art, and I don't know, just something that clings to me in terms of the way it's written. And I don't know, I sometimes can't really explain it. Just you're attracted to this thing and you don't know why. Sometimes you just want to talk to the writer a little bit more to understand them. And I think those are like, those are what I end up publishing. It's like, I see something and like, I want to read more. I want to talk more about it. I feel like if I publish something, it's something that I want to hand to someone else. And say, look at this, like, I don't know why, how to explain my love for it, but read it and then let's talk about it. So I think that's how I approach what we publish.
Yeah, that's a very non-technical answer. It's a very intuitive approach that is, hey, it's whatever turns you on internally, right?
Yeah.
Whatever gets your juices flowing and going like, oh my God, I want more of that. In things we lost to the water, I noticed this idea, this is just sort of like my mind coming at it, the plurality of different things. Even in the title, Things We Lost to the Water could refer in my mind to the refugee experience, the exodus from Vietnam, that we as a people lost a lot of things in that water. And we lost a lot of things to the water in New Orleans because of the Vietnamese Catholic community. There's a lot of things. And I think on a metaphorical, you know, level, there's so much to that. And the plurality of having the different voices in the characters, a different perspective. Is that sort of how you approach your storytelling, like on a tech, I guess I'm asking on a technical level, is that something you think about? Is that something like, is an intention that you approach things a little bit more open-ended where it could be understood on different angles? Or is it just something that you just go out and you just do without really planting the seeds of like the plurality side of things?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I think like the first couple of drafts, like I had no idea of like all this, like you said, plurality. I just wanted to tell a story. I think a lot of writers start that way, just want to tell a story, want to tell it well. But I think it wasn't until like third, fourth, fifth draft that I realized like there's like these different things happening. And like from then on, like you kind of see like where that can take you. You follow that path. So like it's, I feel like almost like it's almost unconscious. Like you write it, but like the back part of your brain was like, hey, this is what all this is setting up to. I guess the short answer is like I didn't plan a lot of what happened in the book, but I think once I saw it happening, I kind of worked that out to see how far I can take it. Like the imagery of water in the book, for example, like I had no idea I was putting so much water in there until like someone mentioned it and like, hey, that what does water mean in this book? What does it mean to the characters? How far can I take this metaphor to mean something to these characters? So I think it's the answer is both. You kind of just do it, and then once you find out that you're doing it, you do it more.
Thank you for answering it. Because I've attempted to write throughout my life, and it's, you know, you can plan for things, but if it's not intuitively coming out, then it's sort of like that authenticity is missing, and it doesn't shape the story that you're trying to, doesn't do service to what you're doing by planning so hard and trying to kind of implant these ideas. And just hearing you talk about the intuitive side of writing is a beautiful thing for me.
Yeah, I think like there's a different types of writer, like writers who plan excessively. Yeah. And like me, I don't plan at all. I feel like planning kind of ruins like where your mind can go, really, like that imaginative part. I think that's what I really like about writing, is just the imagination, especially in fiction. You go wherever you want, and like that's the fun part. And like I feel like there's moments of like writerly joy that like you have an image of what you want to happen in the book, but then the book, the story you're trying to tell, like takes a completely different turn, and then like you write it, and then like that surprise, that joy, like hey, like that's pretty good, and I didn't mean to do that, but it's like a happy accident. And I think those are like the moments, like that's why I write, really, is like that shot of dopamine when like you surprised yourself.
Yeah. What kind of topics are you interested in future novels or projects?
I think like all writers have like these obsessions that they kind of return to a lot, even if they don't mean to write it. I mean, like there's like a saying that all writers basically write the same book over and over again, which means like they explore the same themes. Their thoughts on that themes might evolve over time, or might be just them trying to pin down what that theme means to them and their lives. I think throughout writing this first book and like starting the next book, I feel like the things that are my obsessions are like memory, history. I feel like as a Vietnamese American person, a person in the Vietnamese diaspora, I felt those are themes that are kind of part of our being. Like there's this whole history that kind of follows us around, as for example, the children of refugees. There's that history of the war, but then if you look at the long picture, the bigger picture, there's that whole history of like all the way back to like ancient Asia. Like, so I'm just fascinated by like how do we carry that history? How does that history get told, retold? And then you put in the fact of memory, the fact that memory is always not the best, is unreliable. What does that mean to history? Is history facts, or is it how we interpret it, how we see things, how we see things, but how that changed? So I just find that really interesting, just history and memory and how they contradict each other, how important it is, not just like for Vietnamese people, but really for everyone. Everyone come from someplace else. They can trace history back further and further. And like the further back you go, the more almost inaccurate becomes, but that inaccuracy isn't always a bad thing per se. So I think there's fertile ground to explore in those,
yeah,
those two themes.
History and memory. You know, I think about, as you're telling me those two things, history and memory, I think about like there's other things that that trigger this sort of, my mind is responding to history and memory. I think about like you and I right now in present moment, we are talking about history and memory of the Vietnamese culture. We right now are at the very edge of Vietnam's culture. We're two young guys that are sort of sitting right at the edge of like all the developing things that are happening in Vietnamese culture. I've been Googling the names of Vietnam. There's probably at least 10 names. If you go back in the history of Vietnam, right? It's Vietnam, Annam, and there's all of these names of the different dynasties or different time periods that it wasn't always called Vietnam. And then you start to think about like the history of the different names of those periods. The people were totally different from what modern Vietnamese people are today. And it's crazy. And then you and I are both, you go back 12 generations, we're both a product each of like 4,000 people to get down to one of us. It's like, and talk about the history and the memories. So I think being able to sit in these sort of, you know, have time to sit and explore history and memory and talk about people like you who spend so much time thinking about the history and the memory. And so oftentimes it's not very accurate, but it's a beautiful thing as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think like that, like you said, like there's been so many names for Vietnam, and like there has been also shifting borders of Vietnam. So I think like that's just interesting that like right now when you say Vietnamese, like you, like we kind of know what we talk about, that the strip of land, yeah, and the Mekong River through it, but like it's not always, hasn't always been that way. And that the geography itself, it's history, it's memory. And I think that's something like you said, down to our DNA that's part of us. So I think that's like, I guess, I don't know what I'm saying, but like it's just interesting to think about that, yeah, and how, like you said, we're on the edge of history. We are that all that happened, like from the Trung sisters all the way to like now, like it built up all the way to like ourselves and where we are and the stories we hold. So I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, a lot. And I feel you when you said, but you don't know how what you're describing, because a lot of this shit is nebulous too, right? It's nebulous until somebody like you writes it down, until somebody like you really takes the time to document it. 7 years of your life to document it. T-Bowie with her 10 years of putting this down. And that's so important. And I wanted to really talk about that with you, that we don't have enough voices, I feel, sometimes, you know, that we don't have enough people talking about enough about our history, and you know, and a lot of people aren't really paying attention to it. I feel like sometimes, you know, it's like it's kind of boring for people, but I think it's so important to talk about it, because otherwise it becomes this very nebulous thing and it's not really real if you don't really put it down on some digital form or write it down. It's not being concretized, or I don't even know if that's a word. It's not being, you're not pouring the concrete to make sure it, for future generations, like, no, this is legacy. This is what we as a people have gone through, and we should march and we should be proud of who we are. And I grew up in a generation where that we were not at all. It was very shameful to be Vietnamese in America in the 80s and 90s for me.
Yeah. I think there should be more, not even writers, just like people who archive, like put things down on paper. Cause I feel like we do something, cause like these are this history, this memory, and writing it down is the only way to say like we were here. Like without that record, who say that we even existed. So I think definitely there's a lot to recover, even to talk about, like to be Vietnamese, just to have thousands and thousands and thousands of years to talk about. And really, like, so much of it has already been lost. I mean, like, ancient Vietnam, so like we know very little about that. And there's, like, this was coming from me as a non-specialist, but, like, who is, like, studying that, who is bringing that information forward and remembering those people. And I think writing is important because, like I said, like, it's more almost like an existential thing. Like, are we even here if no one's telling our story? But not only just our one story, but also these multiple stories. And I think that's where artists, writers, why we're still important, why they are so important. Because otherwise, it's really easy to disappear.
Yeah, without stories, there is no identity. It's just, you know, I mean, you look at other groups of people on Earth with 5,000 years of recorded history, whether it be their Bible, their Quran, you know, they've documented thousands of years of the important things that happened in their, even if they were nomadic or they were travelers or they, you know, didn't have an actual home, their diaspora still sort of retained the stories of their old, you know, motherland. And it, that's what makes them able to strongly identify and go forward in the world with a sense of strength, you know, to me.
Yeah, there's like cultures who have documented a lot. I feel like a good example are like Jewish people. Yeah. Like they started off in one place, but then like over thousands and thousands of years, they kind of went basically everywhere. You find Jewish people in every country probably. But like there's that one history of coming from one place, and they have like the Torah, and like that's part of their story that is printed down. And I think like that's how, I guess, Jewish culture has really survived through the Holocaust even, is that they wrote down, even the Holocaust, they wrote down, like after the Holocaust, we see a lot of memoirs, we see diaries, like from Anne Frank, for example, writing her story as it happened. So that writing down is really so important. And I think you risk, if that's not written down, you kind of risk like assimilation in a way that's almost like not even, it's not good. I feel like, for example, the typical white American, they don't know where exactly they're from. I mean, they take a DNA test and say, I'm this percent Irish, this percent German, but there's, beyond that scientific data, there is that loss of what it means to be Irish, what it means to be German. I think that's a risk in America specifically, because we kind of want to force everyone to kind of be the same. And that means loss of something. And that's not just for people of color, but like for white people as well. I think that's, I guess, almost kind of a shame that we kind of become, I mean, like there's the idea of America as a melting pot, but like if it is a melting pot, like, how are we different from each other? How what makes us unique? What makes humanity beautiful? Also, I think that's just, I guess, a thought exercise.
Yeah. It's a nightmare scenario for me to like relive my youth as if I was to live my youth today and be that kid who would go to a party and as a teenager and a garage party with a bunch of white kids, and that sense of non-connecting, the sense of like not really knowing why, you know, how important the Vietnamese culture was. I have nightmares thinking about that today, because there's no grounds. You're not grounded in any sort of like pride or sense of who you are. You're not white. You're definitely not that. You're not part of that, but you're definitely not part of Vietnam, you know, from the motherland. But I think that knowing what I know now about the beauty of the thousands of years of the Vietnamese culture, and if I can instill that in my children or anyone with Vietnamese descent, then you can walk into a garage party or a cafeteria in high school And you have this sense of like, I have this rich history, this past. And you can really, for me, it's just it's such a big thing. I can really settle in and operate and do what I got to do to, you know, be really good at my job, be really good at school. But, you know, without that sort of set, that foundational sense of identity, for me, it's always been like this compass that's out of whack. And, you know, I really identify with what you said about being a writer and you return to these themes. I can never let go of that theme of being this sort of like, this compass that's just like out of whack because, you know, I'm old, you know, relative to young people and Vietnamese Americans in the U.S. I straddle this weird world between like old Vietnam and the new Vietnamese American diaspora, and I can't find my place. And I enjoy it now, and I take great pride in, you know, the fact that that's kind of when I was born. But at the same time, I mean, I will never stop digging more and more and digging up historical and present modern day people that are doing the work of cultural amplification.
Yeah, I think like growing up, like all like or like how many Vietnamese Americans grew up, especially like I guess the second generation, that there's always like for a while, like you could, like you said, like there's like this no place we belong. I mean, like we are not white, we are not black, which at times I feel like those are the races like people think about when they think about American. So like in a way you're not American, but then you're also not Vietnamese because you want to be distanced from your parents' culture, or because you're just assimilating very well beyond like your control. I think you're not Vietnamese either. So I feel like this happens to the characters in my book. It's like there's a while, like, especially the first time he kind of walks this line of not really being rooted, not being anywhere. And I think, I guess like that's almost like why I write in a way,
yeah,
is kind of to make up for that lost time. And that's why like research, especially for the first book, was like important to me, and why it was really personal for me, and why it's the most personal book I can write, because it's kind of retrieving things I lost, which I guess is part of the theme, the novel, even the title.
Yeah. And at some point, do you feel like it's going to be enough and then you move on to another thing? Or do you think that we're always going to set a sort circle around this idea of loss? Let me ask you a more pointed question about that. After finishing your first novel, do you feel like that idea of loss is a little bit more gone? Have you replenished that sense of loss and you feel a little bit more fulfilled?
Yeah, I definitely feel a little bit more fulfilled. I mean, like I'm working on my second book and it's not really focused on loss. I mean, it's focused on memory and history, but the loss, the feeling of having lost a culture really, is not really there. I feel like this first book was this emotional experience. And then now I'm kind of this emotional experience of like going through loss, of interrogating what loss is. I think writing this book kind of made me kind of get over that in a way. And I feel like I can almost write anything now that doesn't need to be lost. It could be about so many other things. And I think that's why any other book would be less personal, because there's like a freedom now. And I feel like it's a good thing. Like there's that freedom to write whatever you want now. But also I feel like I wrote the most personal thing I could write. Like what else can I write now?
Yeah, it's almost like you came out the other end. It's like catharsis.
Yeah.
Have you been to Vietnam?
I've been to Vietnam once when I was a teenager. And I hate it because I had to hang out with my parents the whole time. And like, to me, like they were old people, even though like in hindsight, they were like kind of my age. Like, huh. So But I think like I've been wanting to get back there as an adult. Like I was planning to go back there before the pandemic, but then pandemic kind of wiped that plan away. So like I look forward to coming there as an adult, as someone who is not like a whiny teenager, and just really explore like what it's all about. And like I feel like growing up, like there's always like this image of like communist Vietnam as a terrible place that we're never going to go back, which I feel didn't last my family. I feel like once like relationships normalized between two countries, like they were off. But I think there's, especially for older generation, like there's this idea of Vietnam as a terrible place. I mean, to a certain extent, it's bad. There's no freedom of speech there. People get arrested for what they write. But like there's a new generation, people my age there, who are artists, who are also trying to find their way with maybe what they lost, but also moving forward beyond whatever history they inherited, and trying to do creative things. And it's a totally different Vietnam now from like the 80s. So I think there's a lot to be found there, and that could probably be a different book.
Yeah, definitely. Because all the things that we're saying, a lot of things that we're saying refer to the diaspora, but I think some, you know, a lot of times people in Vietnam don't even think, like when I ask guests from Vietnam, like, what does it mean to be Vietnamese? They look at me like I'm from another planet. What the fuck do you mean? What does it mean to be Vietnamese? I don't know. That's like asking me, what does it mean to be a human being? You know, it's like, there's no attachment to that otherness, you know? And then there's a beauty to that. I find that to be so, I'm envious of that. Very envious of young Vietnamese people who have this sort of completed sense of who they are as a Vietnamese citizen.
Yeah, I think like if you grew up around people who are just like you, there's no question of who you are, because everyone around you kind of shared the same experience, which is something like Vietnamese Americans don't have access to. And I think like part of me like always think like what would I have been like if I grew up not only like in Vietnam, but just like a community of more Vietnamese people. And then I think like, what would life be like if I moved to Vietnam and were surrounded by other Vietnamese people all the time, where I'm not like even the Asian American person in the room. I'm not like where I don't feel like the token person wherever I am. And I feel like it's like a train that I missed almost. And I feel like almost like the story of the diaspora is like a lot of things we lost. But I think, I don't know what I think. I think it's something that I have to kind of live with, because like I didn't have that life. But I think at the same time, I have a pretty good life. Like I have a book. I can't complain.
Yeah. Has your life changed much since the release of the book?
I mean, I want to say not much. I mean, I still write, I still work. But like people who know me, like they got really excited about it. I feel like publication is almost like publication day. Like it's cool to see your book out, but like you feel it's kind of deflating. Like it's like a book, it's right there in the store. But you've been working it for like 7 years, it's in your mind, and now it's finally out. And like for everyone else, like, oh my God. Like it's like for them, like it looks like you wrote it overnight. But like for me, it was like an over 7 year experience. So like it was almost like a deflated relief. I think other than that, people think I'm smarter than I am. Like people would ask me like, what do you think about, like here, what do you think about the Vietnamese diaspora, the Vietnamese identity? And like, I don't know, like I have ideas, but I'm not sure they're the right ideas. So like people, I guess, take my thoughts more seriously now, even though like I'm the same person, and it's weird to be think of as smart.
You know, I wish, I don't see this often, I don't experience this often in families or friends that are Vietnamese, both here in the US or in Vietnam, the idea of like a project that takes 7 or 10 years to finish is normal, is right. It's just a normal thing. And we don't put emphasis on in our families that these things need to happen. Like, we need to emphasize that our new generation and our parents need to be, they need to be schooled. Like, we should be encouraging our youth to take on these decades long projects, because a lot of us think, when we think of Eric Nguyen, we think, oh, yeah, he just put out this wonderful thing. It went on a president's list and, you know, took him maybe a year to write. But the more I dig into writers' lives and filmmakers' lives, and, you know, 10 years on a project is about the right, you know, 7 years is 7 to 10 years is about the right amount of time it takes from inception to getting it out there. And we don't educate within our own community that this is a requirement. We need to start programming our young kids that these things take a long time and we should start now.
Yeah, I think, I guess at least when I grew up, there's mentality of results oriented, like go from A to B, you get to C, you go to school, no, you get good grades in grade school, you go to college, get good grades there, you become a doctor, bam. That's a clear path, but like arts is not a clear path. There's the time to work on that art. There's time to hone that craft. There's even age. I feel like if I was younger and I wrote this book and the book came out, it would have been a definitely different book. Mm-hmm. I felt like, I guess my wisdom wouldn't be there. It's writing the book is, I put my kind of lived experience almost in it. It's not like what happened in my life, but like the way I think about things, the way I see, for example, my parents in my early 20s, they were just my parents, but like writing this book was like, I kind of realized, like, I mean, it's kind of stupid to say, like, my parents are their own person. Like, before they had me, they were in their 20s, they probably had a cool life. Like, I mean, like there's a picture of my parents on a motorcycle in Vietnam, and like for a while, like that didn't make sense to them. Like, how were they young? But like now, like in my 30s, like I like, of course they were once young. Of course they went out, had fun, went clubbing and whatnot. Of course. So I think between like the first draft and say like the my year 6 or 7 of writing it, like I came to that realization. And I think without that realization, this book would not have been the same. It would just been me thinking someone in the 30s was like very old. But I think it's not just like the process of writing, it's also the process of growing up and understanding the world better. And I think that experience is definitely needed. And like, you can't really quantify that in terms of a timeline. I mean, and people also like grow up at their own pace. So like, it's, I think if we told people, if we gave insight into like that creative process, not only to young Vietnamese Americans, but just young people in general who want to be artists, I think they come to better understand the profession and the process.
Yeah. Singing and music for Vietnamese people as a profession is an absolute no-no. There's proverbs and, you know, really sticky proverbs as, you know, sinh ca vô loại and all of these things that really make the profession of music just a very bad thing. But okay, so there's a negative kind of aspect to that, but then there is this sort of like other side of it is like, if you do pursue it, there is a lot of money to be had in it if you do it right, but all of it takes at least a decade to develop. Whether you want to sing, you want to write, you want to dance, it takes 10 years minimum, in my opinion, to really have this cultivated sense of what you're doing and the use of your voice, whether it's you're a writer or a composer for film, it just takes that amount of time. And when we start to raise a new generation of people, we have to start bringing this into their kind of like their awareness that we need more amplification as Vietnamese Americans or Vietnamese diaspora. And these are the years that it's going to take. And I think once we clear the air on that, then there is a big chance to make some good money. And I think, like, if we approach it the way the Jews do, you know, they're in for a long haul, and create it. And in the process, we find our voice. And after we find our voice, it will be bought and it will be sold and it will become commerce and there will be money to be made. But we don't believe yet, you know, as a community.
Yeah, just, I guess if I could tell my parents that I want to be a writer as, like, a teenager, I would definitely tell them, like, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah.
But, like, be patient. Even though I don't think my parents are really patient, but I think, yeah, definitely. And the thing about art is, like, when you first start out, you don't even make a lot of money. Even if you, like, to everyone else, like, you look at success, it's not until, like, you build a career in the arts that people start paying you more. So I think, like, just think about the long haul, just the long picture, the big picture.
Yeah. Eric, thank you so much today. I covered a lot of things that beyond what I had set out to ask. And a lot of the things that I got today was about intuition and intuiting sort of like the way you're going about your creations.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I feel like, I don't know. I don't know if I said anything useful, smart, but I like the conversation. I think we've covered a lot of topics I don't think a lot about, but I guess it's in there somewhere.
Yeah. And I think there's, you know, before I sit with anybody, I watch a few interviews and read a few articles, and I try to avoid the things that you've already answered. You know, I try to skirt around the things that, you know, you can find online and stuff like that. So I just want to get to more of the essence of the artist or the person that's creating these experiences in the Vietnamese American or Vietnamese diaspora.
Yeah, I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Eric. I appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcast. Thanks again for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.